How's everybody?
Good.
All right. Everybody's car will blow up instantly at 1 minute after midnight. I heard that coming over the mountains today. Computer chips in the cars are going to go bad.
Okay.
It takes me a little while to get going with one of these. My name is John Hendrickson. I'm an alcoholic. And this room was the scene of the very first convention I ever went to. I've been clean and sober in the program Alcoholics Anonymous since April 7th of 1983, and I am truly grateful for that. And I was about 4.5 months of sobriety in 83 for one of the Seaside conventions. And I remember sitting up in the balcony up there, and one of the speakers said, "This is what it's all about. When you look at the sea of faces and the hope for tomorrow, that the newcomer who may be in this room today is like I was a newcomer back in that room in 83. And I remember the phrase, if you never want to take another drink for as long as you live, John, you won't have to. So to start, and I'm really tickled that I get to be number one here, I've met a couple of the speakers. I've met David from North Carolina, and Wayne from Nolens. Did I get that right? Nolens? Oh, you're from Nolens. You're from Illinois. And you're going to have some fun and laughter for the rest of this convention. I noticed on the flyer that my anonymity was blown completely. There's a lot of people in this room that has heard my story so many times that you know what I'm going to say next, and I'll endeavor to make up some more shit as I go along here. I'll keep you off balance a little bit. I spoke down southern Oregon, or in middle Oregon, couple of months back. And one of the guys that I sponsor is here, Greg in the back, with his brand new, beautiful wife, Dale. I see him back there. I was asked to come down and be the Saturday night speaker, and I've been telling this joke about Clinton for a long time. And the punchline is silence. And you don't say the word that's a punchline of the story because it's offensive. And I told the story and I used the word and I went right on. And I suppose I got to tell it now, don't I? Because the tape, if you want to get the tape from Terry over here, it's known as the BJ tape of Judge John. So that's a... The Supreme Court of the United States has just stuck it to President Clinton one more time. And I love that. It seems as how there was an application made to put a nativity scene on the White House lawn prior to Christmas. And somebody in the ACLU objected to this, and I always pay attention to what the Supreme Court says. And they submitted an application, the Supreme Court heard it, and they said no. No nativity scene on the White House lawn. Turned down the administration. And it wasn't because of a prohibition against separation of church and state. It was because they couldn't find three wise men and a virgin in Washington, D.C. I got a phone call 2 weeks ago. I thought, you know, I've only been sober 16 years and coming up on 17 years, and I've been, as you'll find out in a minute, when they get a judge sober, you know, it's kind of an oddity, and so they start propping you up all over the goddamn place real early in sobriety. And I've been doing pitches at conventions and speakers meetings for about 14 years. And I remember sitting up in the balcony 16 and a half years ago listening to the speakers that were here, and thought, well, gee, someday maybe I can be up there. And that's a good goal if you have it. And I really appreciate being here today to share with you. But I got this phone call 2 weeks ago. I thought, you know, I really must have arrived as a speaker in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was from a convention in Long Island, New York, wanted me to come and speak. I thought, how wonderful that somebody had listened to a tape of mine in Long Island. And this guy was kind of funny sounding, and he said, I said, well, what is the month? And he gave me the month and the time, and And I said, well, what's the name of the convention? And he said, it's the Alternate Lifestyle Group of Long Island Convention. I said, alternate lifestyle? He said, yeah, it's a gay convention. I said, why are you asking me? And he said, well, we got a call from some lady in Oregon City that says you were a good gay speaker. Was one of my ex-wives. So I don't get to go to Long Island, so. Most of you who are real alcoholics in this room, I will qualify. I remember who I was with, what I had to drink, and how old I was, and the day of the week, and what the temperature was when I had that first real drink of alcohol. And I was 13 years old in Southern California in a little town called Huntington Beach. And I was in a cornfield at my house with two other little geeks like me. And I had stolen from my grandfather's barn a wide-mouth quart mason jar full of rock and rye whiskey. And those of you who don't know what rock and rye is, it's 100-proof old Yellowstone where you put strings of rock candy in it to dissolve. Stuff tastes pretty sweet, but it does get the job done. And I had stolen some cheese glasses. You remember those old things from, those of you who are old enough, you remember that product called Cheese Whiz? Remember that? You gotta be an alcoholic who named that shit, right? Cheese Whiz. So I had these little glasses out in a pup tent in the cornfield with this quart of rock and rye, and I poured a cocktail for my friends in the evening. And these cheese glasses, those little guys, they drank that, and they got a little giggly and ran around circles and had a good time and fell down and went to sleep, and I drank the rest of the quart. And I remember what it tasted like, and I remember more than anything else what the hell that stuff did to me. You got to remember that, realize that it, when I was 13 years of age in Huntington Beach, California, I was 6'2", same height I am now. I had size 12 shoes, same size shoes that I have now. But I weighed 129 pounds. And I had to concentrate real hard just to walk. And nobody liked me, you know, especially the girls didn't like me. I was just kind of the Ichabod Crane of the community, this geek that was in school. And I didn't belong in that neighborhood. I didn't belong in that family. I didn't like those people. And I didn't really have any friends. And I put that stuff in my guts and swallowed a little bit of that stuff, and it swirled around, got a little warm, and stayed down. And an explosion happened inside of my psyche that was absolutely magic. I can taste it. I can remember what it felt like to this very moment. And I was instantly 200 pounds and coordinated. And I was going to be the captain of the football team and the basketball team. And I was going to be the best swimmer the world had ever seen. And I was going to have all the good looking... No, I was going to have all the girls is what I was going to have, you know. That all occurred within the first 5 minutes. And I finished the rest of that court, and I'm having such a great time all by myself. And sometime half an hour or so later, I started throwing up on a regular basis all night long until by morning I was throwing up blood. And my parents got very concerned. And most people who have an early drunk like that and they get real sick and throw up blood, their head would tell them, you know, don't do that anymore. You know? We don't like that up here. But all I remembered was what it made me feel like. I didn't give a damn and I was throwing up blood. And every time I went after a drink after that, I went after that feeling that it gave me. And for the longest time, it worked. It always made me feel better. It always made me fit in wherever I was. And I became everything I thought about in that cornfield when I was 13 years of age. I became that world-class athlete behind that alcohol because I had the courage to do anything. And in fact, when I was 18 years of age, I was selected as a member of the United States Olympic team in 1960. I didn't get to go. You'll find out in a minute. When I back up here a second, when I always start these things, I always look for stories in Alcoholics Anonymous because stories to me, I don't know, you can tell me about the program. You can read from me from the book. You can describe to me phrases in the big book, and I hear them at meetings, and most of the time I just don't get it. But you tell me a story in AA, and the light will come on, and I will understand. And this was an Alcoholics Anonymous story when I first heard it, but it was after I got a hold of it. You know the rule here. You know, Wayne knows the rule. You tell a story in Alcoholics Anonymous three times, it's yours. So this is my story. This is my entire relationship with the drug of alcohol. It's one of my favorite stories about booze. Little story about a little drunk who lived in Seaside, Oregon. And this little guy, every morning when he got up, he was a little hungover, and he always went for a walk on the beach to wake up and shake the cobwebs out of his hangover. And this one little morning, he tripped over a sand dune, and a lamp popped out, and he picked it up, and he brushed it off, and a genie appeared in front of the little drunk right out on the beach here in Seaside. The genie looks a little drunk and says, "I am not your typical genie. I don't grant three wishes. What I grant is one gift and one wish. And the gift is my choice," she tells the little drunk. "And I see from your appearance that you're a drinking man. And I would like to know, sir, what is your favorite type of alcohol?" The little drunk thought for a minute, and he said, "You know, I'm particularly enamored with that stuff that comes in the heart-shaped bottle, in the velvet blue bag, Canadian Crown." Al, you're drooling down here. Don't be doing that. "Canadian Crown Royal." And she said, "All right, sir." And she waves her hand across the sand, and magically appears in front of the little drunk is this giant bottle of Canadian Crown Royal. And the genie explains to the little drunk, this bottle has magic powers. It will never go empty. And he uncorks it, takes a big couple of hits off of it, puts it back on the sand, and watches as it gurgles right back up to the top, brim full. Does that a couple of more times, and each time the bottle gurgles back to the top with the golden liquid, brim full. And the genie looks a little drunk and says, "Now, sir, your wish. You may have anything you want in the entire world. It is yours. What is your wish?" And he thought for a minute, and he said, "Give me another one of those." That's as good as I can do it, you know. All through my drinking career, they said, "You know, John, the guy with the check is at the end of the bar." I'd say, "I'll be right down. Let me finish this drink." I'd finish the drink. I'd get down. The check would be gone. All my life, the check was gone because I had to have that one more drink. Oh. My sponsor, I have the same sponsor I had when I first got here in 1983. I was about 2 years sober, and he called me up, and he said, "You're going to speak, John, up in Washington State at a convention of alcohol treatment providers." I thought that was pretty nice. You know, I was a couple of years sober and very full of myself. So I went up to speak on this Saturday night, and I did a pretty good job, I thought. And it was the first time anybody had ever taped anything. I don't know whether it was Terry on Timar Tapes or some other taping outfit, but they sent me the tape in the mail. I thought, this is really neat. Got my name on it. So I'm going down to the beach again on a weekend, and I shove the tape into the console of the pickup truck, and I'm listening to myself do this pitch up in Washington. And I got about halfway through it, and I noticed a couple of things. I didn't do any of that shit. I was just kind of making up stuff as I was going along, you know? So I very sheepishly called my sponsor and told him what I had done, and he reminded me quite sternly of the principles of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the one that is read in Chapter 5 at every meeting, at least on the West Coast, of the principle of rigorous honesty. And those of you who are new in the program, or maybe some Al-Anons, who don't know what the principle of rigorous honesty is, it is simply this. Now, honesty in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is admitting that at one time in your life, quite possibly, you engaged in masturbation. Rigorous honesty is admitting that you still do, you know. That's the difference. I was 18 years of age and at a training session in Southern California for the Olympic team, and I got through the training session and walked out to the parking lot, and there were some deputy sheriffs from Orange County, California, and they arrested me. Put me in jail. Me, an Olympic athlete, for Christ's sake. I was pissed. Seems as how, and I got arraigned the next morning in front of some imposing large female judge in Orange County, California. Seems as how there was a gross misunderstanding in my community. What I would do, evidently, was I would invite myself into your house without having first been asked, and then borrow shit that didn't exactly belong to me. And I believe in, even in Oregon today, they call that first-degree burglary. So I was arraigned on some 14-odd felony counts of burglary in that time. And my parents propped up some lawyer, and I don't remember anything about what happened there, except I pled guilty to something, a couple of felonies. Before I was sentenced, this large, imposing judge looks at me, and she said, "Young man, I understand that you may have a problem with the consumption of alcohol." And that really pissed me off. Because I knew that my parents had probably turned me in. And this lady says, "I'm going to get some information to you, and there's this new outfit in town." Now, this is 1960 in Southern California. She says, "I'm going to have you go to 5 meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous." Goddamn judge in 1960 sent me to 5 meetings of AA. I went. It was across the street in my hometown in Huntington Beach from the pier and the Boar's Head Bar. You had to go through the bar to get to the back room where the meeting was. And I was obviously a little drunk when I got there. But I went to those 5 meetings. The only thing I remember about it, it was probably a half a dozen real old guys in that room. Don't remember much of what they said. Shit, they must have been 30, 35 years of age. You know, their life was over. What the hell do they know, for Christ's sake, you know? And I went to those 5 meetings. I don't remember much about them. And I'm back in front of that judge, and she says, "Well, that didn't work. And we're going to do a pre-sentence investigation." So she sent me to a treatment center. Well, in California in 1960, they didn't have treatment centers. You know, we got treatment centers coming out of their ass today, everywhere. George Brooks, Rattlebox on the Glen, you know, Serenity by the Throw Me Up Against the Wall in Seaside. And I mean, they're everywhere. But in 1960 in Southern California, they called them state mental institutions, you know. So I spent 30-some days in Norwalk at the mental institution with paper slippers and a nice, pretty green suit, and did the Thorazine Shuffle for about 30 days. They would send these doctors around to talk to me. And this very mysterious psychiatrist would come and talk to me on a Wednesday. And he had this question. He sat down, very mysterious, and looked at me, and he said, "Young man," he said, "I want to know how you feel about your mother." So I told him. And another doctor would come and talk to me on Friday. And he'd ask me the same dumb question. So I would tell him how I felt about my mother on Friday. And these guys got to comparing notes, decided I wasn't being honest with them, so I got kicked out of a mental institution, for Christ's sake. Back in front of that judge, and she threw her hands up in the air and said, "Well, obviously, with your attitude, there's no help for you here." So she sentenced me to a term of months in a Northern California state penitentiary. And as far as I know, and those of you who know me, I am a judge in the state of Oregon. I am the only sitting judge that has ever been felony convicted and in the United States that has spent time in a penitentiary, as far as I know. Well, she sent me to a term of months in a Northern California state penitentiary, and I went. I'm 18, 173 pounds. Blonde hair, blue eyes, real cute. And luckily, I wasn't in that place very long. In those days, you could get out of penitentiaries and jails and go into the military. One day, some recruiters came through the day room at the penitentiary in Northern California. And these guys were had blue suits on. They were from the Air Force. And they were looking for people with talent. I promptly raised my hand. They were looking for musicians. And I'd been forced to take piano lessons at gunpoint by my mother a long time ago. And I raised my hand, and They threw up some music in an old upright in the day room. I played it, and the sergeant came over to me, and he said, "Young man," he said, "we want you to be a member of the United States Air Force." I looked at that sergeant, and I said, "You mean I get out of here?" He said, "Yes." I said, "Thank you, sergeant." That's my kind of sergeant, that guy. I spent 4 years. I got out of the penitentiary. I spent 4 years in the United States Air Force. Let me tell you what I did. Defending you from your enemies from across the big water. I played the piano at the cocktail lounge in the officer's club for 4 years. It was really exciting stuff. The most exciting thing I ever did for 4 years was I was stationed one time in Ramey, Puerto Rico, gorgeous base down there. They had a giant piano bar, a grand piano where they had stools around it. I had a brandy snifter sitting up on the, in case you liked what I played, you could put a buck or two in. Every night at 5:30, the base commander's wife and her entourage would come in to have their martinis. And about this time in early 1960s, there was a song on the radio that was all the rage. It was called "I Left My Heart in San Francisco." It's a beautiful song. And the base commander's wife asked me if I could play that song, and so I played it in the exact style that was on the radio. And she clapped after she put a dollar in a brandy snifter, and she bought me a drink. About 15 minutes later, I thought it'd be polite, base commander's wife and all. So I played it for her again. And she politely clapped and put another dollar in a brandy snifter. I had another drink. And about 20 minutes later, I decided maybe she might like this in a different style. So I played it as a rumba. And then it hit me. You know how we can be brilliant sometimes, you know? Sitting at the end of the bar and we get this flash of brilliance. I began to play "I Left My Heart in San Francisco" in rapid succession, in every style I could think of. My best memory is that I played it some 60-odd times in a row. And they got to laughing and giggling, and they filled that brandy snifter up with dollars. And that's the most exciting thing that happened to me in my entire career in the military. I have to be careful listening to the Golden Oldie station on the radio nowadays. If that song comes on, I get a little nauseous, you know. I got out of the military, and I got married while I was in there. Had a kid. Yeah, I think I had a kid. Yeah, I had a kid when I was in there. I married this beautiful young lady. She was 18 years of age, a virgin, which is every young man's dream. So, God, it was awful. she didn't drink, and I did, and she was a devout Catholic. In fact, she was in the... What do they call those places? They're going to be nuns, the nunneries, convent. She was in a convent when I met her. I was in there playing the piano for some kind of beauty contest for somebody, and I met her in there, and we got married when I was in the military, and she taught me about all of the mysteries of sex in the Catholic religion, and I wasn't a Catholic. I had to convert to Catholicism in order to get laid, in order to get married, and so I did that, and we got married, and man, that's frightening stuff. I mean, she taught me that growing up as a young girl, she was taught by the Catholic nuns that sex was dirty, it was filthy, and it was nasty. And you were supposed to reserve that for the one you really loved. Oh. So we got out of the military, and I went back to college in Southern California, and I had various and sundry jobs and got out of undergraduate school at a very prestigious little school where they had such notable graduates as Nixon and Reagan and all of those boys. I managed to get myself up to the state of Oregon in 1970, and I entered law school. And by this time, I had another kid and the same wife. And I got out of law school and became a lawyer in the state of Oregon in 1973. And the very first job I had was prosecuting drunk drivers. And I was really good at it. And they couldn't figure out how come I didn't lose. And I couldn't really explain to them, you know, just one drunk just can't lie to another one. You know how that whole story goes. And I got out of there and I went into private practice with another guy that drank just like me. And And about all this time, I'm with this beautiful little 18-year-old girl that was my wife and mother of my children. And she became very sick. And she didn't drink. She became the most shrewest, ugliest, hateful woman you ever want to meet. You know, and it was all the direct result of my drinking and my broken promises. And I'll describe for you what I call the communications ritual. And it's important for me to remember this stuff. This may be something that is reminiscent of your past, or it might be something that's going on in your household right now. I would get home anywhere from 7 o'clock till midnight, every night, after work, always a little boozed. And we managed to get the kids to bed, and she would always be in bed first. And I would get in bed and sneak way over to the side so there wouldn't be any personal contact. And she would ask me the question. She would say, "John, did you lock the front door?" And I would say, "Yeah, I locked the front door." She would say, "I bet you didn't lock the goddamn front door." I would say, "Okay, I'll check." And I'd slam out of bed and run down the hallway and go to the front door, you know, and lock it. And slam back in bed, and she would say, "You always do that to me." And I would say, "Susie, for Christ's sake, I don't want to argue with you tonight." And she would say, "Don't you raise your voice to me." And the fight was on. You know, I'd had it about that time. I grabbed the pillow and the sheet, and I'm out the goddamn door going down the hallway. I'm going to the study. I'm either going to sleep in the goddamn chair. I'm not going to be put up with that kind of crap in my own bedroom, you know. And she'd be right behind me. Chip, 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 yip, 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 all the way down the goddamn hall. Get to the door, I'd push. She'd push and try to get the thing closed. If I got the door closed, I'd sleep in the chair. If I couldn't get it closed, I'd push past her, go out and get in the truck, go down to the local bar, and bitch about her to the bartender until it closed. That was every night. Every night. Until one night, and the very last time that that beautiful lady and I were together, same story. Same running down the hallway to the study. Same pushing and shoving at the end of the hall. Same screaming. And I picked her up and I snapped and I threw her across the room, and she was a small girl. Hit her head against the wall, and she got up dazed and in a rage, screamed at me with the top of her lungs and ran at me and put her hands on my chest. And I set her aside, walked out of the house, and I never went back. And I got in my pickup, and I lived in Salem, Oregon at the time, and I drove from Salem to Oregon City, about 40 minutes. It's about midnight to the guy I worked for, another lawyer. Knocked on his door, and he opened the door, took one look at me, and he said, "John, what happened to you? Were you in an accident?" And I looked down, and my shirt and my pants were soaked with blood, and the sneakers I had on were full of blood, and I was leaving bloody trails down the steps to his house. And what had happened was, in her rage, when she came at me at that kitchen, she put her hands on my chest with those fingernails and pushed through my ribs and severed a vein. And I was bleeding to death, and I didn't even know it. And Ron took me to the emergency room, and the little doctor in the alcove fixed me up. He looked at me, and he said, "John," he says, "I know about you. If you don't do something about your drinking," he said, "you're not going to make it." You know, and I knew he was right. Well, you know how we are. I was a lawyer, for Christ's sake. You know? It's written down some goddamn where that I'm entitled to drink martinis. I just know it is. But I knew he was right, but you can't tell him that, you know? And I made the first and biggest mistake of my career in drinking. I looked at this little doctor and I said, "You think I drink too much, Doc? I'll quit." And I did. Next day, no trouble at all. Didn't have a drink. Might have helped that they loaded me up with a whole bunch of painkillers, but I didn't have any trouble having a drink that next day. Second day, no trouble at all until about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Neck muscles got a little tight. You know, I got that general overall feeling of being irritable and full of discontent. Read that in a book someplace. But I didn't have a drink that second day. Third day I woke up, I had shit crawling all over me, and I couldn't get them off. And I knew I was in real serious trouble. So I went to the only solution I had ever known. I went to psychiatrists. I went to 6 psychiatrists. at the same time. One each in a different community. And guess what these learned men of the psychiatric profession wanted to know about me? They wanted to know how the hell I felt about my mother, for Christ's sake. 20 years, nothing had goddamn changed in that profession. And I'd lay some story on these guys, and one doctor thought I was suffering from some kind of a Valium deficiency, and he would load me up with 10 milligram on, you know, unlimited refill prescriptions of Valium. Some other guy thought I was really going to calm down, and he gave me 25 milligram prescriptions for Thorazine. And another guy thought that I had an attention deficit disorder, and what the key to me was that he gave me prescription speed, and so I had a whole pocket full of black beauties. One guy didn't want me to have drugs, but he thought that I should be hypnotized. Now, this guy was wonderful. I would go to his place on Friday afternoon. He would sit me down, he'd get his watch out, and he'd hold it in front of my face, and back and forth in a monotone voice said I was getting very sleepy. I'd close my eyes. He'd go over, open up the bar on the side of the house, pour himself a giant scotch, sit down with his newspaper on the couch, hoist his glass, have a drink, and say, "Here's to you, asshole." He'd come over, snap his fingers 20 minutes later, write me a prescription, and I was out of there. That was his gig. So, toward the very end of my drinking career started in 1980, and I am not one that advocates talking about drugs from this podium, and I do not generally do that, but it is part of my story. I adhere to the singleness of purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous without question. Let me describe for you what I looked like 6 months before I got to you in the program Alcoholics Anonymous in 1983. I weighed 284 pounds. I had shoulder-length pageboy hair. I wore black leather hats with wide, hard brims, the black braided ponytail off the back. I had a beard that completely covered my chest. I had 8-inch white mustaches that I bleached white with Clorox on each side of my beard. I wore fake white mink coats to the floor. And I wore baby roses on the left side of the beard. That's the way I showed up at the courthouse. I would show up, people would just kind of go away, you know. They didn't know what to do with me, I didn't know what to do with me. But in order for me to get my costume on, I would have to go through the night before and the morning. I desperately wanted to stop the drinking. I wanted to stop the pain, I wanted to stop the terror, and I didn't know how to do it. And I would make a promise to myself at the end of every afternoon that I was not going to have a drink, and I would fight that steering wheel all the way to my favorite bar, or whatever the hell bar was still taking my bad checks. And I would sit down at the end of that bar at the late in the afternoon, and that bartender knew what I wanted, and he'd take a big roly-poly glass, and he'd fill it full of some amber liquid that I happened to be liked at the time, and I would choke that down looking for that feeling that I had in that cornfield when I was 13 years of age. And the feeling had left me a long time before, and it became necessary for me to drink as much as I could possibly get in my system on a daily basis in order to survive. In order for me to get up and go to work in the morning, I would come to about 5 a.m. after having passed out at about 3 o'clock. I would have to reach in the drawer and get a handful of speed and chew that up. And I'd have to lay flat on my back near the shower until the heart evened out and the flutters would stop. And the cramping around the heart muscle would stop. And I'd get in the shower and take that scalding hot shower in order to just wake up a little bit, put on my costume and get down to the courthouse. I couldn't hold anything in my hands, so I would hide out in the bathroom, or I would hide out around the corner, or I'd hide in my office. Somewhere around 10 o'clock, I would have to eat some other kind of medication in order to calm me down enough so I could hold anything in my hand so I could run out of that place at noon and go down to the nearest bar and do what I really wanted to do, and that was have a half a dozen double hooks or whatever the hell I was drinking at the time. I would maybe get back to the office, maybe not, do a little work. I'd have to take an equal amount of either Thorazine or Valium at the end of the afternoon in order to calm down again, in order to get me down to the bar at 4:30 in the afternoon so I could do what I needed to do. And I became that very hard and daily drinker. I consumed about a fifth and a half of alcohol every day. And somewhere around 2 o'clock in the morning, every night, after having consumed that amount, I would start the nightly ritual to try to get out of the pain and the terror. I would drive around the freeway on West Lynn, Oregon. And at that time, they didn't have a barrier between the lanes. And I would look at the 10th Street exit and try to hit just right where that 18-wheeler would be coming up on the bottom side. And every night I would find that truck and I would pull that car of mine over to the edge, trying to get enough courage to travel down that embankment and hit that 18-wheeler and end my life and end the pain. And just before I could turn that wheel enough to go down the embankment, the tears would fill my eyes, and I couldn't see, and the courage would leave me. And I would drive back to the office on the banks of the Clackamas River in the dead of winter in 1982, and I would stand on the banks of those high rocks on the Clackamas River in the freezing water and try to get up enough courage to step off into that water and die. And the tears would come down, and I would lose my courage, and I couldn't do it. And I would drive home at 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning, and pull the car into the garage and pull the crate out, and sit in the dark and pull out the 9mm and load it and put it in my mouth, and pray to whatever God or whatever thing might be there to help me, to give me the courage to end my life. I can still hear the strain of the spring. I can still taste the gun oil. And I couldn't do it. And the tears would fill my eyes. You know, I know today that the God of my understanding gave me one chief character defect that I'm very grateful for. He made me 100% totally chicken shit, you know? I couldn't hurt myself. So I was married at that time to my second wife, who thought that there was something worth saving in this man who lived in her house. And she called the man who was my sponsor of the Oregon State Bar, and they decided to do an intervention on me. So they threw this net over me and got me to a little doctor in Lake Oswego, Dr. Ken. He's the Alcoholics Anonymous doctor. Ken is dead now. He died sober. And I defended Dr. Ken on all of his drunk drivings. I'd saved his medical license by putting him into treatment when I didn't even know what the hell treatment was for in the 70s. And Ken was sober when I went to talk to him in 1983. I'm sitting across from his desk, and he had taken some blood from me, and he comes back in the room, and he sits down, and he says, "John, here's the results of your liver functions. They are all over 450. Your liver is 2.5 times its normal size, and you will die with an exploding liver inside your body in 6 months, and you will die screaming." And he explained to me what that was about. And he got up from the other side of the desk, and he walked around, and he put his arm on my shoulder, and he said those magic words that I heard in this convention room in 1983. He said, "John," he said, "if you never want to take another drink for as long as you live, you won't have to. There's a place we can take you so we can learn. You can learn about what's wrong with you." And he said, "Will you go?" I said, "Shit, yes." You know, it's a pretty good intervention, one-on-one with a doctor saying, "Here's your choices, John. Let's see. You can die, or we can take you over here and maybe you'll be just fine." You know, so I decided I would, I'll do whatever they wanted me to do. And so my wife drove me to a not-so-fancy rattle box downtown Portland, overlooking the Bowery of Portland, Burnside. And I told my wife on the way down to this treatment center that there were two things I was not going to do. I was not going to have anything to do with this outfit called Alcoholics Anonymous, because I'd been there and it didn't work. And I was not going to talk about God, because he, she, or it did not exist. And My wife, then wife, assured me that that wasn't going to happen. And I get into this treatment facility and find out that the entire place is run on the 12 steps of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that John was going to have to talk about God whether he wanted to or not. And I was an arrogant, ugly, hairy, smelly man that was educated far beyond his intelligence, and I knew everything. You know? And they would get me in these... How many people in this room, this is a beautiful crowd, has ever been in a treatment center? That's about 50%. Okay? If you'd asked that 25 years ago, there'd have been about two. Well, all of you who raised their hands know about the unity concept of treatment. That's where you never do anything by yourself in the treatment center. Everybody gets up at the same time, together. You have to make your beds together. You have to sweep the floors together. You have to eat breakfast together. You have to take a crap together. You know, everything is done together. Nobody can do anything by themselves, and you got to go in these funny little rooms together, and they have an alcohol counselor who gives you a lecture. I'm there the first day, and they started talking about God. I'm up out of my seat and in the hallway. I don't want to hear about God. And you know what has to happen? All of your patients, your inmates, have to come out in the hallway and talk your ass back in the room. So four or five times a day for the first 4 days, I'm out of my seat every time the word God is mentioned in the standing in the hallway. They're coming out talking. They got tired of my ass. My sponsor, his name is Don. He is my friend. He came to that treatment center every night. He's a gentle soul. Took me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Different meeting every night. He would come to that hospital. He'd say, "Get in a car. Shut up. Take me to the meeting, talk to me on the way to the meeting about what happened to him in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Go to the meeting, he'd tell me where to sit, tell me not to talk. I couldn't say one word because I didn't know nothing. Talk to me about how it was with him in sobriety on the way back to the hospital. Kick me out of the car, tell me he'd be back the next night. And the fourth night, I got enough courage to say, "Don, they want me to talk about God. And I can't do that." And he said, "Why not?" He said, "Because God doesn't exist." He says, "He doesn't?" He said, "Yeah, they're talking about this third step, and they require me to turn my will and my life over to the care of God, and I can't do that." And he hands me the book that's sitting on the front seat of the car, and he asked me to read him the third step of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I started reading. Made a decision to turn our will and our lives over. He says, "Stop." He says, "You have had English construction language courses. You understand the English language. Read it again. What does it ask you to do?" And it says, "It asks me to turn my will over to God." He said, "No, it doesn't." Okay. Made a decision. He said, "Stop. What does the step ask you to do?" "Oh, make a decision?" "Yeah." He pulled the car over to the side of the road, and he explained to me in 2.5 minutes the 12 steps of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It saved my life. He looked at me in that seat. He said, "John," he says, "you don't have to turn your will over to the care of anything. It's all you have to do is make a decision. And how you make that decision is the first 3 steps of the program. Bill and Bob and the first 67 some odd members wanted us to know what they did. And what they did was, the first 3 steps are like the emergency room of a hospital. They will keep me sober long enough so that I can make that decision. That decision is, am I going to keep my ass in this chair, in this room, at this meeting now and get well, or am I going to go back out there and try it one more time on my own where all the pain and all the terror is? How I turn my will and my life over," Don told me, "is that Bill and Bob wanted us to know how you turn your will and your life over is really simple. And treatment centers have complicated this shit for the last 25 years. You do steps 4 through 12. If you do steps 4 through 12, John, magic is going to happen, and you're going to get the only guarantee that this program ever offers us. And that guarantee is that if I do 1 through 12 to the best of my ability, my spirit will be awakened. I will know the God of my understanding. My will and my life over to the care of my own God because I did the work to find where God is for me. So he said, go back to the hospital, John, and, stay there. I wasn't buying it. Next morning, I'm out of my goddamn chair again. And those of you who know Bobby Yee and know that he's in a little serious physical problems for a long time, he saved a lot of people's lives in this program by the words that he used. And there was a man in that treatment center that was there 21 days longer than I was. He was a biker from Goldendale, Washington. His name was Jeff. He was the only guy in that treatment center that was bigger, uglier, and hairier than I was. The guy was a spiritual giant. He's a member of the Goldendale Warriors Motorcycle Club. And he was tired of me, and he had heard a tape from Bobby Yee. And I'm popped out of my chair on the fifth day. And if this offends anybody, I apologize in advance. But this is part of my story, and this is what turned the tide for me. And I'm out in that hallway, and Jeff's popped out of the other side of the door. He's standing at the end of the hall, and he looks at me, and he screamed at me from the top of his lungs. He said, John, if God's not up there, you're fucked. And that's the most spiritual third-step prayer I ever heard, you know. I had no response or no answer for that. I went to Jeff, and I said, what the hell do I do? He said, you open your mouth, and you ask for help, whether you believe or not. I said, okay, man, I'll do it. And I went down to my room, locked myself in the bathroom, turned the light out. Ain't be nobody seeing this big old cool-looking judge praying, for Christ's sake. And I sat on the crapper, and I simply said this. I said, hey, man, if you're there, they tell me you can take away all this pain. And if you would do that, I'd really appreciate it. And unlike Bill, the bathroom didn't light up and the wind didn't blow through. You know, but I turned that light on and I looked in the mirror. And I had never seen that man before. And I unlocked the door and I walked out of there and you looked different. And I felt different. I knew somehow in the deepest part of my guts that everything was going to be okay. I had a feeling of wholeness inside of me, and I didn't know what happened to me. That feeling has not left me one moment since April of 1983. And I was suddenly consumed with a brand new fear. And that fear was, as I was walking down that hallway, I thought, oh my God, I got to get out of this damn hospital, go get a black suit and a little black string tie, and carry religious literature door to door. But I didn't have to do that. I got out of that hospital and I did exactly what I was told. With my sponsor, within the first 1 year, I did the steps of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Okay. I found the God of my understanding that had saved my life 4 or 5 days sober in that hospital room, in that bathroom. I found that God. I want to tell you about the power of God in the program in my life, and where the real benefits of this program come. You know, I get asked to be people's sponsors more than I should, and I make the world's rottenest sponsor. You know, I am terrible. I tell you what, George, you want me to be your sponsor? Come to my office Saturday afternoon, 3 o'clock. We're going to do the 4-step. I'm going to show you how to get started. I'd show up. He wouldn't be there. Next time I saw him, he said, well, I had something to do. I said, here's $20. Go get drunk. Don't bother me. You know, you got to be serious if you want this thing. My sponsor is different than that. He will come after you and come after you and come after you and keep dragging you around until you either die or you get it. And I wish I was that way. The power of God in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous started for me in demonstrations in my life in the ninth step. When I got to you in 1983, I was $681,000 in debt. The bank wanted the house, they wanted the business, the Oregon State Bar Association wanted my license, the Judicial Fitness Commission was sniffing around the corner, the edges, you know, wanting to know why this guy didn't show up on time and kind of smelled like lime gimlets all the time. I never drank a lime gimlet in my life. Anyway, I had that eight-step list, and I went to my sponsor, and he said, we're going to start here, John. I had worked in a liquor store in Southern California. for 3.5 years. And every night I stole a bottle of booze and a $20 bill. And the owner of that liquor store was on my list. And when you added that time up and the $20 bill and a bottle of booze, it came to $27,640. I owed that money. He said, fine, the family. So I called Claremont, California, asked the dean of the college where I was in school if he would get me the phone number of the Gourmet Liquor Mart. He said that been bulldozed many years ago. It's now some kind of a mall. So he got me the phone books from his secretary, and they looked up William B. Coonian, Jr., was the name of the owner, and all of the communities in Southern California, and nobody could find him. I called the California State Liquor Control Commission, and they said, we don't keep records back past 10 years. I knew that the family was from Canada. I called the Canadian consulate in Portland, Oregon, gave them the name, and said, I need to find this family. They found me 3 William Coonians in Canada in 3 different provinces and gave me the phone numbers. I called all 3 of them. None of them knew who I was talking about. None of them had ever been in Southern California, much less owned a liquor store. In great frustration, I went to my sponsor and I said, I can't do it. He said, why not? He said, I can't find them. He said, read the step to me again. Made direct amends wherever possible. He said, it's not possible right now. I said, you mean I don't have to pay the money back? He said, no. I said, oh, God, I love this step. This is a great step, this step. I tried to be a bigwig developer in the state of Oregon in the 70s, and I got caught in the interest rate crunch and drinking at the end of the bar. And I owed $451,000 to the Seattle National Bank. And it seems as how I'd signed a personal guarantee. And the Seattle National Bank is on my list. And I had no money. And he said, no, you call him up. He said, says you got to make arrangements. I said, but they're suing me, Don. He said, well, what would you advise somebody who was suing a client of yours to do? I said, what, hire a lawyer? He said, yeah. Let me tell you about the power of God. I hired a sober member of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, a lawyer in Portland, had 2 more years of sobriety than I did. Okay? Turned the problem of the Seattle National Bank over to him. I had signed this personal guarantee, and if I get crunched with this judgment on this personal guarantee, the Bar Association is going to take my license immediately. He called me up one day, and he said, John, he said, when did you sign the guarantee? This is going to get a little technical, but this is important. I said, I don't know, a couple of weeks after I got the money on the loan, the guy called me up, the loan officer, and said, I forgot to have you sign this. You've got to guarantee this personally. So I went down and signed. Here's what had happened in the God of my understanding. When I had made the decision in that treatment center that same week, when I asked God to take away all this pain, that same week, the old National Bank of Seattle had a proxy fight. The new stockholders won, kicked out and fired all the board of director members. Put in new members of the board of directors. One of the board of directors members had a son-in-law, was a lawyer in Portland, Oregon. Fired the old firm, hired this kid's firm. Turned my case over to the new kid for prosecution against me. The kid, the young lawyer, had just come back from San Francisco, called my lawyer after he looked at this file, and he says, I should let you know that the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has just established that if you don't get paid separately for consideration for a personal guarantee, it isn't effective. Would you please call Mr. Hendrickson and find out whether he was paid for his guarantee? My lawyer called me up and said, were you ever paid anything extra for it? I said, no. He said, fine, I'll call you back. He called me back the next day. The deal was this. If I were to sign the property back over to the bank, the debt would be forgiven. $451,000 just disappeared. Didn't have to pay it back. You want to tell me about the power of God in the program Alcoholics Anonymous? That is not coincidence. I worked in Salem, Oregon while I was going to law school. I managed the Northgate Lanes bowling alley. Had a bar in it. I stole a bottle of booze and a $20 bill from that man every night. I calculated what I owed him. I knew where the man lived. I went to, had a check in my pocket. I went, this is I'm 9 months clean and sober. I went to Brooks, Oregon. I found his house. Knocked on the door, and I could hear music, and nobody came to the door. And I wandered around the back and I looked through the sliding glass door of this little house. And I could see Sam on the couch laying down. And I could see in front of him on the coffee table was a half gallon of booze half full and some empty cans on the floor. And I pushed the sliding glass door open and I went in and I said, "Sam, are you okay?" And he was half drunk and he was crying. And I said, "Sam, you don't know me." He said, "But I used to work for you. And when I worked for you, I stole money from you, and I have this amount of money that I've calculated that I owe you back. I am in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. In order for me to stay sober, I must make it right for all people I had harmed, and you're one of those people." He looked at me, and he handed me a sheet of paper from the in front of the coffee table, and it was a foreclosure notice on his house. And I gave him the check. Then he cried, and he said he didn't have to lose his house. And he thanked me, and I went away, and I called a friend of ours in Woodburn, Oregon, who sent two senior center sober members of the program Alcoholics Anonymous to Sam's house, and they 12-stepped him, and he died sober 5 years later. You want to tell me about the power of God in the program Alcoholics Anonymous? The power starts with that ninth step, folks. It starts with that ninth step. The last story I'll tell you... In my law library in my office in Gladstone, Oregon, I had stolen a set of books from Willamette University College of Law Library. I didn't check the books out and refused and failed to turn them back. I'd stolen the books. And they're sitting in a volume set in my library. And every time I walked in the library, I'd see those books. Every time my sponsor would visit, he'd point to the books and say, "When are you going to do that?" I said, "Yeah, I'll get around to it, Don." The last time he said, "You better do something about it." I'm 9.5 months sober. I said, "Okay." I called the dean of the law school, made an appointment with him, put the books in the back seat of my car, and drove from Gladstone, Oregon to Salem. Takes 40 minutes. I knew that by the time I got through with this little soiree down in Salem talking to the dean that I was going to be in jail. My head had me convinced. I went down, sat in front of the dean's office, on the couch, had the books. They thought I was a book salesman. Secretary came out and says, "You have 5 minutes." And I went in. I put the books on the dean's table. I said, "Dean, my name is John Henriksen. I'm a lawyer and a judge in the state of Oregon. And I graduated from this university in 1973. And I'm a recovering alcoholic in the program Alcoholics Anonymous. And I must make amends to all people and institutions I have harmed. And this institution is one of them. And I'm here to return these books that I stole from the law library and to do whatever I need to do to make this right." And his mouth dropped open. And this is what I heard. "I don't know what I'm going to do about it. I'll let you know. You're excused." I got back in my car, drove the 40 minutes back to Gladstone. My head had me convinced by the time I get back to the office, the sheriff is going to be there, I'm going to be in jail. Okay? Nobody was there. A month later, I get a letter from the dean of the law school. It says, "Dear Mr. Henriksen, thank you for the return of the books. We have discussed your situation with the trustees of the law school. They have checked, or we have checked and found out the good work that you are doing with lawyers helping lawyers in the committee for the state. We want to encourage you to keep doing that in your program. And we have decided that if you would write a check in the amount of $200 and donate it to the law library, that would suffice to make, as you call it, amends for your error." I wrote a check. I put it in the mail. I sent it out. I called my sponsor. I said, "How wonderful." He said, $200. I'm off." He said, "That's great." He hung up the phone. I forgot about it. A month later, I get a letter from the librarian. "You want to know about the power of God? Let me tell you. Dear Mr. Henriksen," says the librarian, "thank you for your donation of a check for $200 to the library fund. With your permission, sir, I would like to take this money and buy a 5-volume set of Alcoholism and the Law and put it in the library. And further, sir, with your permission, I would like to have a plaque made that says donated by Judge John Henriksen, class of 1973. Now let me get this straight. I stole the books. And now I've got a plaque in a library that says how great thou art, you know? Tell me about the power of God. It's absolutely amazing in this program. The promises on 83 and 84 of our big book in all three volumes say that those things will not occur until you do the work. Until you're halfway through making those amends, will not those things happen for you. So if you haven't done the amends steps, get your ass to your sponsor, drag out that musty old 8-step, you know, and let's get the work done. Magic will happen for you, and you'll be on that final leg of the journey to having that spirit awakened. And I mentioned before that I love stories in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they mean so very much to me. And there was one story that I was 5 years clean and sober. Now, there's a lot of people, you go to conventions and they go to the countdown. Between 5 and 8 years, there has always been a dearth of people. You don't know where they've gone or whether they've gone out back to drinking or not. But it happened to me at 5 years clean and sober. I got fed up with the program Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I knew what Mike was going to say. You know, I obviously knew what Al was going to say. You know, old George over in the corner, what the fuck does he know? He's so goddamn crazy, you know. It became more important to stay home to watch the Blazers on television, go bowling, you know, something. I went from 7 meetings a week down to 1, and the only reason I was going to 1 is because it was in my office and I had to be there. I went to a convention, I heard this story, and it literally changed my life. When I went from 7 to 1 meeting a week, it took me about 6 months. I didn't pick up a drink. I picked up the gun again. Because the world started pushing me around, resentments came running back in, and I couldn't and didn't want to exist in this life one more day. And I found myself contemplating suicide one more time. And I'm driving down to the beach, and I'm going to do myself in down at Lincoln City, and I plugged a tape in from my sponsor, Ray O.K., and it came on from the tape the exact point in time in his story where he makes the deal in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the deal is this. Okay, God, I'll be a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous if you'll please do all the rest. And the tears came running down my face, and I realized that I was not a sober member of this program. I was not going to meetings. I was not talking to newcomers. I was not returning phone calls. I was not sponsoring people. I was not a sober member. I had welched on the deal. And I plugged in another tape that I hadn't heard from back east. And I don't even remember the man's name. And the following story came out. Simple little story about a little old man lived in a small little country in Europe. And this man owned this magnificent white horse. And this horse was desired by kings, and the royalty would come to the old man and offer him vast sums of money to sell this horse, and he would look at the people and say, I cannot sell my horse, the horse is my friend. And the townspeople would shake their heads and say, old man, you're stupid, you should sell this horse. Get the money and move into town and live like a king. He said, I cannot sell the horse is my friend. And about 10 days later, this horse ran away into the mountains. And the townspeople came out and shook their head and said, see, old man, it was a bad thing. You should have sold this horse. Because now you cannot sell the horse and move into town and live like a king. It was a bad thing. And the old man would look at the townspeople and shake his head and say, I don't know that it's a bad thing. All I know is the horse was my friend. And now he is gone. But I don't know that it's a bad thing. And about 10 days later, the white horse comes bound from the mountains and he brings with him 6 other horses. And the townspeople came out and say, how wise you are, old man. It wasn't a bad thing. It was a good thing. Because now you have these 6 other horses, and you can break them and sell them and still move into town and live like a king. The old man would say, I don't know that it's a good thing. All I know is that I had this horse was my friend. He went away, and now I have these other horses, but I don't know that that's a good thing. And about this time, he set his 16, 17-year-old son to the job and the task of breaking these horses in the corral. And while the son is on top of one of the horses, it threw him off to the corral and broke both of his legs. The townspeople ran out one more time and said, "How wise you are, old man. It wasn't a good thing. It was a bad thing, because now your son has two broken legs and he cannot be any use to you." And the old man would look kindly at the people one more time and say, "I don't know that it's a bad thing. All I know is the horse was my friend and my son has two broken legs." He said, "But I don't know that that's a bad thing." And about this time, the small little impoverished country went to war against a large neighboring country. And the government came through and conscripted all the able-bodied young men to fight in this losing war, and all the parents knew their sons were going to die. But you see, the old man's son didn't have to go, because he had two broken legs. And there is no end to this story. The exception in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, in chapter 5, we hear it at every meeting. I have to get rid of all of my old ideas, even my ideas of right and wrong and good and bad. You see, I am the last person in the world that should interpret what happens in my life, because that's what I did all of my life, you know. All I do now when something happens that I don't care for, say, "Well, I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing. I'll just sit and wait to find out." You see, the results of what I do in life are God's business. What I'm supposed to do is what's put in front of me. What's put in front of me. What time we got? I gave my watch away. Oh, Christ, we got... The second hour is going to be a lot better, I think. We got... How many Al-Anons do we have in the room? Ah, isn't that great? The only complaint I had the last thing I did was that I didn't tell an Al-Anon story. And my lovely, beautiful bride back here, Victoria. Those of you who know Victoria, she's 6'2", just beautiful. Weighs about 125 pounds. Her legs go all the way up to the back of her head. You know? She and I are having a wonderful time in our new marriage. We've been married a little over a year now. We go everywhere together. We go to conventions together. She has her own meetings. I have my own meetings. We have made a commitment when we first got married not to interfere with the separate road of recovery. And we don't do that for the most part, except to say, "Get your ass out of here and go to a meeting," you know, which is a prerogative that we should have. And the only, you know, that she is so beautiful and so tall and so thin, the old guys from the West would know this, you know, that making love to her is kind of like making love to a gunny sack full of antlers, you know. it's you have to live on the West Coast and all that. That's a private joke that we have. So.
Didn't get it.
Yeah, we got asked, or I got asked to go down and be the token speaker at the Oregon State Convention, Al-Anon Convention, a couple of years back. And I searched around for an Al-Anon story, and I found one. Well, it wasn't an Al-Anon story when I first found it. It became it after I told it. I just love this story. This is dedicated from the alcoholics in the room to the Al-Anons in the room. And it's a story about this farmer who lived in Seaside. And he was a tremendous daily drunk. And his wife was just fed up with him. And she didn't know what to do with him, so she calls the family doctor. And the doctor says, "Bring George in." So she loads George up into the pickup truck and goes into town to the clinic. And they give this farmer every known test. The heart test, the stress test, the blood test, everything. They just all day long with a test for this guy. And at the end of the day, when all the tests are done, they call the wife in and sits down and talks to the doctor. And the wife says to the doctor, "What's wrong with my husband?" He says, "Well, he's suffering from a lot of stress. That's why he drinks too much. And I have a plan for you that if you will follow this plan, your husband is going to be fine. The stress will be eliminated." He says, "Well, what should I do?" she said. And he said, "Well, tomorrow morning you start..." I know he starts his farming activities at 5 a.m. "You please get up at 4. You make him his favorite breakfast. Pork chops and biscuits and gravy and a hot pot of coffee. And you give him a pot of coffee and you put him in the pickup truck and send him out to the field with a big hug and a kiss. And then in the mid-morning, you go out and find out where he's working in the fields, and you bring him some more fresh coffee and maybe a piece of pie. And then at the noon meal for supper, you bring him back in and you make a sumptuous supper that you worked at all morning long. and at the end of his meal, you prop him up for a one-hour nap in his favorite chair. Send him back out to the fields with a new fresh pot of coffee. And when he comes in tonight, at night, you have this sumptuous dinner made for him with all of his favorite foods, with his slipper, and then at the end you have him sit in front of the television set with his pipe and his tobacco, and you sit by the arm of the chair and ask him how his day was. And if you will do that every day for 60 days, your husband will be just fine. Driving back to the farm, husband is sitting on the right, wife is driving back, and he can't stand it any longer and says, what the hell did the doctor tell you while he was in there? She looked at him and says, he told me you're going to die. That's dedicated to the Al-Anons in the room. So, I have to go do this tonight at another convention, and I just so Vicki and I've got to take off here in a few minutes. And I end one of these things the same way that I always do. It's a story that I heard a long time ago that I memorized that they did on the floor of the World Convention up in Seattle. And I'll end with this, and I want to thank you. And I always reserve until the end to thank the committee for asking me to do this, and Harland and your hard work for coming up with the idea to have this celebration of the new hope for beginning tomorrow morning for all of us. I wish to thank you, and I will close with this, and this is called The Auctioneer. The auctioneer stood before the crowd, and he went over to the table, and he picked up the violin. It was all battered and scarred and covered with dust. And he held it up to the crowd and said, what am I bid for the old violin? Who'll bid a dollar? Maybe $1. How about $3? And from the crowd, $1 came, then $2, and then $3, going once, going twice. And before he could say, sold, said he, from the back of the crowd came shuffling through an old man. It was all battered and scarred like the old violin. He came up to the auctioneer and he grabbed the violin and picked up its bow and began to tighten its strings. And he set the violin to his chin and placed the bow and began to play. And the melody came forth such as the angels sing. And he handed the violin back to the auctioneer and shuffled back off into the crowd. And the auctioneer held the violin up and said, now what am I bid for the old violin? And from the crowd, $1,000, then $2,000, then $3, going once, going twice, sold, said he. And another voice from the crowd said, what changed the value of the old violin? And another voice said, it was the touch of the hand of the master. And I submit to you that in my limited years in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have seen over and over again the healing of the battered and scarred alcoholic soul, made whole, happy, joyous, and free simply and solely by the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and the touch of the hand of our Master. And I thank you and I love you and have a wonderful convention.